Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Castle Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can download our podcast on iTunes or listen to our show on restaurantguysradio.com.
And you can follow us on Twitter, at Restaurant Guys. Hello, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm terrific.
This is my first show back since having visited the Balkans. I was actually out at the Balkans International Wine Competition. Crazy, huh?
Well, I would say interesting, but I don't know.
No, really, it was. It was crazy. It was held in Sofia, Bulgaria.
So what wines were there? What wine producing countries were in Bulgaria?
Serbia, Bulgaria, Greece was there because that's on the Balkan Peninsula.
Okay.
You had Serbia, Bulgaria.
Now we've talked about Greek wines on the show before, and
yeah,
and
I think
they reemerged first from this area.
I mean, people don't often think of Greece as a Balkan country, mm-hmm. and Greece was, Greek wines in this country have a foothold that's been building for years, and the other Balkan wines don't. Right, you don't see a lot of Bulgarian wine out there, but
I haven't tried any wines from those other places yet, but I have tried the Greek wines, and they are very interesting and very good
and getting better all the time
and getting better every vintage.
Now, in the Balkan countries, countries that I tasted a lot of wines from were Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, Bulgaria. And that's where most of my tasting was centered.
And did you have experience with those types of wines before this?
Not a one. Literally never had a Bulgarian wine before I was in Bulgaria. Never had a Serbian wine before I was in Bulgaria. And this was a competition. The panel of judges was distinguished wine people
professionals from all around the world.
Yep. I was not a judge. I was there as a participant. And which is not to say I'm not distinguished, because, you know, I've got gray hair. But I really found a whole new thing. And what's interesting is this is an emerging wine region, but it's also a historical wine region. And you know that, for your listeners out there, need to know that's what Mark and I love to find, is people who are resurrecting traditions that were lost, you know. And I think that comes from growing up with bakery bread, and sometime when I was six, my mother switched to Wonder, and now I'm back in, you know, I'm like, why did you do that? You know?
When did a hot dog roll become a hot dog roll?
Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of the theory we're
based
on.
And here's what happened in many of the Balkan countries. I mean, World War II dealt a serious blow to wine production in the Balkans, mm-hmm. and in Eastern Europe in general, in Hungary and Slovakia as well. And then after the war, communism was no great friend of high-quality wine. I mean, that goes for Hungary, that goes for Slovakia.
Sure. You know, any of those countries that were behind the Iron Curtain, if profit was not the motivation, well, it's a lot more work to make great wine.
Right. And also, you know, you had, let's remember, after World War II, there was a glut in wine. So you had a worldwide glut and not very much demand. So you had problems in Bordeaux and Burgundy as they mm-hmm. tried to rebuild and were looking for...
Right. The great Bordeaux's at that time were selling for $6 a bottle.
Right. And, they did things like look at the region of Puy-Fouissé, which back before World War II was a little area around Puy and a little area around Fouissé, two little villages in mm-hmm. in Burgundy, in the Mâcon. And after World War II, they said, oh, it's that and everything for like a mile, 2 miles in each direction. You know, mm-hmm. I'm exaggerating it. But they expanded the borders because they needed the revenue. So you have this worldwide wine glut. And, you know, the communism wasn't very good at producing artistic things. It wasn't very good at producing, you know, fine quality things. Plus, you know, quality wine, the wine that wasn't the wine of the people, was kind of decadent, and unless you could sell it to the West, there was no home market for it. And most of that wine had been drunk in that region before World War II. So it really, you had wine traditions disappear or just become, you know.
So did you get any of the backstories about how it's reemerging and
you know,
why it's happening now in Bulgaria?
Well, first of all, I want to say that one of the things that was really wonderful about this wine conference, a guy I met named Dusan, who's really terrific, he's a Serbian guy, who hangs out with Croat winemakers and Bulgarian winemakers, and he calls it wine diplomacy. You know, the people at that table represented countries that even very recently, Serbia and Croatia,
sure.
have not exactly gotten along post-communism.
Mm-hmm.
And but the wine people do, and the wine people are building the bridges. And Bulgaria, as it is getting ready to join the European Union, the economic community, and maybe the euro, we'll see. The Europe is spending a lot of money in Bulgaria and
in infrastructure.
In infrastructure, yeah. And basically, you're seeing some world-class wineries going up there and some really talented people who are really passionate about the wine.
I think most of our listeners would be surprised to hear that there are world-class wineries being built in Bulgaria right now.
You know, they're new, but in Bulgaria and Serbia, there's a tremendous people see that if they can make great wine, there will be a market for great wine.
Well, are these areas conducive to growing great grapes?
They have thousands of years of history of growing grapes. You know, they always grew great grapes. And then we had this traumatic incident of World War II, and then communism never allowed it to come back again. And now we're at an area where there is the interest for it. They are private sector economies again, and now you have the subsidies from Europe in many cases, which provide the capital. And there is a lot of capital in these places. And you know, they're doing two things. And I'm overreaching here. It's overly broad. It seems to me that they can make good, some of them can make good and Western European varietals, Cabernet Sauvignons and Merlots and Syrahs. I had a couple of Syrahs from Macedonia that were phenomenal. But I don't know whether it's that their winemaking isn't right in many cases. I had some very expensive Cabernets that tasted like they were made in an oak box. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it was just an oak and no fruit.
Well, you see that in California as well. So.
Absolutely. So I don't know whether it's that the winemaking hasn't caught up yet. But what I found was, even if they make a good Merlot, who cares? I mean, the world needs another good Merlot from a new place. I didn't find them to be unique. I didn't find them to be great. What I found to be great were native varieties that are sometimes written in Cyrillic, and when they translate into the Roman alphabet, they don't have any vowels, so they're very hard to pronounce an all-consonants name. I'm exaggerating, of course. But I went to an advanced seminar on Vranac, which is V-R-A-N-A-C. Phenomenal. It was Macedonian Vranac from the different wine regions of Macedonia.
Does it have a comparable grape here?
No.
Is there something that...
No, I do not think it does.
Was it white or red?
It was red. It was a red grape, and it was delicious, and it really, I got to see not only good examples of it, but I got to see good examples of it showing different senses of terroir or different senses of place from within Macedonia. It was fascinating. I had a Serbian Prokupac, which is Prokupac, I think.
I'm sure that's wrong.
I think it's right, actually. I spent a little time there, you know, and it was gorgeous. It was gorgeous. And I tell you, here's what we're gonna do. I do want people to try and follow us on Twitter if you can. Sometime in July or maybe August, but probably July, I am going to tweet. I brought four bottles back, and I am going to tweet a time that I am going to just the next day open four bottles that I brought back at a certain time, and if anyone wants to come and try them, they can come and try them, and when they're gone, they're gone.
Are you going to pick a day I'm away?
I'm going to try. So it's at Restaurant Guys. Follow us, and I'm going to try and do a little more stuff like that. We would love to have more listeners to the show, more people following us on Twitter. But if anyone wants to go check out the Eastern European, or frankly, the Balkans wine scene, email me, Francis, at restaurantguysradio.com, and go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and you'll find under this show some links to some organizations you can look into. And if you run into trouble and you want some advice as to where to go, you can email me, and I will set you on a fantastic tour to, from our perspective, an as yet undiscovered wine region that's going to be really important 10 years from now. Really important. So check it on out. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. And today we are joined from his vineyards in Peru by Johnny Schuller. Johnny is an author, chef, restaurateur, distiller, television personality down in Peru. And he's also the founder and proprietor of Pisco Porton, which is something we're going to talk about for the rest of the segment.
Johnny Schuller, welcome to the show.
Hey, Francis, Mark, thanks a lot. Great to be with you guys.
So you are actually speaking to us from your vineyards in Peru right now.
Right now, I'm in Ica, about 300 kilometers south of Lima, in the vineyards of La Caravelo, the oldest working distillery in the Americas.
That's just
beautiful place.
That is so awesome. And if you guys want to see a video, if you listeners want to see a video of this place, you can go to piscoporton.com and check out the video. It's pretty wild. Johnny, why don't we start off with you telling our listeners what is Pisco?
Well, Pisco, Francis, is a distilled spirit made from wine. It's not a mark. It's not a distilled spirit like Agrapa made from pomace. It's a distilled spirit made from wine, and it's regulated by a norm here in Peru that's very strict. We have only a delimited regional geographic area where we can grow these 8 particular Vitis vinifera grapes that historically, for the last 350 years, have been used only for the production of Pisco. Pisco is distilled in copper pot stills, in single distillation. It's a product that has several singularities that make it really, really wonderful in the world of spirits.
So
one of them is that it is... Excuse me?
No, so basically, we're going to start from the premise of this is a brandy. This is a true brandy.
All right, we don't want to call it a brandy because we want to be our own category. We
right.
want to be recognized as Pisco, right?
Okay, fair enough.
Basically, yes. Basically,
okay.
In the world of spirits, we could call it a brandy that is unaged and unwooded, right?
Right.
So it's a product that does not go into oak, and it's not aged. It's rested for, in the case of Porton, it's rested for about a year, year and a half before being bottled. Because we need this this product to evolve, to mature inside large containers. It is a brandy, unaged. It's a clear, crystal product. It's distilled in copper pot stills like a brandy. It's single distillation like most brandies. It is distilled to proof. That makes a big difference between the rest of the spirits that are made from grapes or from wine, like cognac or brandy or Jerez. That are tainted by the oak, right?
Well, let's,
we don't want that.
I want to ask that question. Nearly every place in the world that distills wine and either into brandy or pisco or other spirits, nearly every place in the world ages that in oak barrels. Why do you choose to not do that for pisco?
Because again, Francis, we are made from wine. And what we're looking for is, like in a wine, when you have a Cabernet Sauvignon, a Merlot, a Malbec, a Syrah, you're looking for the original aromatic structure of the grapes. This is what we're looking in Piscos. You have a Pisco made of pure Quebranta grape. You have a Pisco made of Torontel grape. You have a Pisco made of Italia grape or Muscats. And what we're looking for is the original aromatic structure of the grape. Not changed by an external addition. We don't borrow flavors from oak. We want our flavors from nature, from the earth, from the terroir, like in wine, because it is made from wine.
You know,
so this is what we're looking for. We put our nose into a glass of pisco, and we're smelling the aromatic structure. Each grape has a basket of aromas, flowers, fruits, spices, that different differentiates each grape, like in wine, like Cabernet from a Merlot or Malbec.
You know,
this is what we're looking for.
We don't
want that. We want that structure to remain unchanged.
You know, Johnny, one of the things, we have a lot of experience with Pisco. We love Pisco. It hit the American market currently. It's been in the American market for a long time in one way or another, but it hit the American market currently, about 7 years ago or 8 years ago up in the Northeast. We first discovered it. And I've enjoyed Pisco in cocktails, and people should know that the Pisco Sour is the most popular cocktail in Latin America and becoming one of the most popular cocktails in America. And of all the Piscos that I've tried, and there are a few out there that I like, yours is the only one, and it's funny that you talk about maintaining the grape variety, you know, the character of the grape variety, that I enjoy sipping. And we had the opportunity, you were at the restaurant recently, and we did a dinner with Dale DeGroff, and you and I sipped more than a few glasses together, not in a cocktail. And you know, it's,
right.
But it's, you know, I think Porton, Pisco Porton is singular because it really, you know, it's a white spirit that you can sip. And that's the first time I've experienced that in a Pisco. Is that traditional to drink that way in Peru?
So my argument is Pisco is for friendship. Pisco is for drinking. Pisco is for conversation. Porton is a friendly drink. Right?
Yeah.
It's Pisco can be used for cocktails. Porton has been designed with a concept of cocktail making. Oh, you've tried it. We've done it with you and with Dave. And we're having a wonderful time with mixologists in the States. But in case of Porton in particular, it is a wonderful, 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 wonderful spirit to drink on its own.
Do people drink Pisco in Peru and Chile on its own generally? Or is it always made in a cocktail?
I think more in Chile is more mixed, and their popular drink down there is piscola. In Peru, yes, our tradition is to drink it straight, to drink it neat.
Well, let's talk a little bit. We have to bring up the differences here between Peruvian Pisco and Chilean Pisco. I know you're very proprietary about your Peruvian Pisco and the name Pisco. And so tell us a little bit about the differences between Peruvian Pisco and Chilean Pisco.
I have to start a little bit, Francis, if you allow me, with the history. The port of Pisco, which is very close to where I am right now, was founded around 1500s, late 1500s. And there is where the Spanish conquistadores shipped this beautiful spirit that they found here, that they grew here because they brought the grapes down. You know, the missionaries needed the grapes for wine making, for mass on Sundays. Mm-hmm. So the production was so abundant that they turned it into a spirit. Then began to ship the spirit from a port in Ica, that's called Pisco, which is very close to where I'm standing. That gave the name to the product. The town of Pisco in Chile was founded in 1937, several hundred years after we did. I'm not arguing that both countries at the same time had grapes and they were producing a spirit, but theirs was not called Pisco, ours was. Now, the difference that you're asking for, one of the main singularities that Peruvian Pisco needs to have is that it is distilled to proof. And in the norm, that means, Francis, and I know you guys, your followers are all basically great experts in the world of spirits.
But we may as well tell all the listeners. But we may as well tell all the listeners what we mean by that.
So the world of spirits, most spirits are distilled to a high proof. Gin, vodka, whiskey, tequila, cognac, Armagnac, rum, they're all distilled to high proof. Chile. And how do they bring it down to bottle proof? Is by addition of water, which is a normal standard procedure, right? You know that. We all know that.
Of course.
It's against the law. It's against the law in Peru. So in Peru, it has to be bottled at the proof it comes from the still. This is distilled to proof.
And that's a much more expensive way of doing business. And that's a much more expensive way.
It's a much more expensive way. Sure, because I need about 18 pounds of grapes for a bottle of Porton.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Because I'm not distilling to high proof. I'm getting rid of heads or tails. I only use the heart, and the heart has to have my 86 proof.
We also have to tell them what heads and tails are. I think a lot of the people who don't know distillation as well as we might might not know what heads and tails are.
When wine, because, again, they were not made from pomace. They're made from wine. First, I have to make a wine, Francis. I have to ferment my grapes. I crush my grapes. I ferment them with natural wild yeast. We do not use artificial yeast. We use natural wild yeast. We ferment it. Fermentation finishes. It is a raw, fresh wine. Right? It's not a finished wine, but it is a wine. Because the juice has no alcohol. You can't distill something that has no alcohol. So the yeast has transformed the sugar into potential alcohol. The wine is a fresh wine. You take this into a copper pot still. You fire it up. The first vapors, the first steams that come out are the heads. The heads carry a lot of aromas that are very light alcohols that you don't want in your finished product because it will change or will affect the aromatic structure. Once you have a few liters of that steam condensed, then you by the nose, you smell it, and you've found that these aromas are gone. Then the heart begins to flow. You separate the heart, it's another container. As distillation begins to end, you're going to begin to lift the heavy alcohols, which have aromas like nail polish remover and things like that that are not nice anymore, then you cut again. And the tails are out, and you only keep the heart, the center part of your distillation process. So my whole process, I only use about half of what I distill. And in the case especially of Porton, it's a Mosto Verde, Francis, so worse, because I distill my wine when it's sweet, not when it's dry. So I need about 40% more grapes to make a Mosto Porton than a regular Pisco.
And a Mosto Verde is when you make a wine, but, you know, if you make a wine, we're getting really technical here, but this is really important stuff. If you, when you make a wine, you add yeast to a grape juice which has sugar in it, and if it eats all of that sugar, if the yeast converts all of that sugar into alcohol, you have a dry wine. If you stop if you stop the fermentation process before that's done, you have a slightly sweet wine because you've stopped the yeast before it's eaten all the sugar, and so that makes for a really unique sweeter wine. You'll find that in a lot of German wines that have a touch of sweetness to them. And so obviously that's another step to make your Spirita de Mosto Verde.
La Mosto Verde, and you're absolutely right. And that sweet wine is the one we take to the still. This translates into clarity by reflection of light that I always say is like melted diamonds in a crystal glass. I mean, the translucency, the beauty of that light. And I think he's got a beautiful light bulb inside. It's just liquid diamonds. Silver that was brought out from the Peruvian Andes and melted in Ben Marie and served in a crystal glass for enjoyment. You know, the light is absolutely beautiful. Yeah. And then what it gives is that sugar that has been in the wine does not go through the still because sugar doesn't evaporate. What evaporates are alcohols. But those alcohols are rounder, are more complex, are more interesting. They have picked up all the aromatic structure from the grape and they carried it into the final product. And then at the mouth, the feel, how it explodes in your mouth, Francis, it just fills it up. And when you swallow it, you have the smoothest, well, I call it something, liquid velvet that goes down the throat. You know? It's so smooth, it doesn't burn your throat. It's absolutely a gentleman's drink.
So I interrupted you while you were telling us about the differences between Chilean Pisco and Peruvian Pisco.
All right.
If you want to finish that thought.
The climatic conditions of these deserts, and I'm looking at the end of my vineyard here, it's a desert. The sand dunes, nothing grows absolutely. We are irrigated by trickles of glaciers that melt from the Andes and come down this way. Otherwise, the whole coast of Peru is a desert. Now, this generates a lot of heat during the day and a lot of cold during the night, perfect for grapes, rain grapes, right?
Right.
Which we all know that that's a perfect condition for grapes. But that heat during the day evaporates water and concentrates sugar. This doesn't happen in Chile. Chile, in their first distillation, as they go through the still, their product, like cognac that has to do it in two-step, Chile's product comes out at 23 or 24 degrees of alcohol, not enough for bottle proof. So what do? They need to take the heads and the tails, they put them in the rectifying column, they turn it into pure alcohol, wine alcohol, fair enough, and then they add this to their pisco, which lifts the alcoholic volume degree value to about 76 or 78 degrees, and then they have to add water to bring it to the 33 or 35% alcohol they sell. They sell a pisco around 70 degrees of alcohol, right? A 70 proof.
Right.
So their product is about one-third real pisco and two-thirds water.
Wow, yeah.
A cognac is about one-half, you could say, pisco and one-half water. Peruvians, we cannot use water. This is a very, very, very important element, Francis. This is something everybody has to know. We are absolutely, by law, by norm, distilled to proof.
You know, I think that is fascinating, and the differences between, I'm attending a seminar down at Tales of the Cocktail, where we're both going to be in a short period of time, in New Orleans, I mean, on a difference between Peruvian and Chilean Pisco that I think is fascinating. And it's an emerging ingredient. If you're a bartender and you're listening, or if you're making drinks at home, you've got to have Pisco behind your bar, and it takes a little knowing about, because it's not in our cultural lexicon right now, but Pisco was available in the United States before Prohibition, wasn't it, Johnny?
It was. It sure was. It was the drink in the time of San Francisco. the time of the 49ers. You've got to read the book by this book that's called Barbary Coast, that was written by Herbert Asbury, that talks about the cosmopolitan life of San Francisco in the 1860s and 70s. And he talks about the most popular bar in San Francisco, the best appointed bar in San Francisco, was the Bank Exchange. And the most popular drink in the Bank Exchange was Pisco Punch.
Pisco Punch.
And he calls it the most expensive drink in San Francisco at the time. It cost a quarter. Right?
That's
Nobody
great.
Knows the secret, how it was prepared, but it was. And those testimonies are there, the writings, the historians. Everything is there. And Pisco, and he describes, the secret of the preparation of the Pisco Punch was Pisco, a brandy made from Italia. Rosa Peru comes from Peru, from the port of Pisco, from where it was shipped, and it takes the name from there. The testimonies are there.
You know, it's funny. I remember reading about that bar, and one of the things the proprietor of that bar used to do is he would take his Pisco Punch recipe, and he would go in the back and lock the door, and he would he'd mix it all up, and so not even his bartenders knew what was in his particular Pisco Punch. Isn't that you've heard
no,
that story? You've heard
Duncan
that story?
Nickel, yeah, it was his name. Sure, Duncan Nickel. He would have, and he was a huge, huge secret, and he died with it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Wild stuff. Hey, listen, Johnny, we need to take a quick break, but I want to come back on the other side and talk a little bit more about Peru and Chile.
Sure thing.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Johnny Schuler. He is the proprietor of Pisco Portón, a television personality, and probably the world's number one ambassador for Peruvian Pisco. So, Johnny, I was first drawn to your product from some stuff you sent me by email and in the mail about the distillery that you built down at one of the oldest distillery sites in America, in the Americas. We have one of the most modern distilleries in America. Can you tell us about what you did down there?
The story is very interesting because the project is actually formed by my partner, Bill Callop, who's a Texan billionaire who had sold his ventures here in Peru and decided he wanted to do something for the country and decided that this was going to be a very interesting venture. And he approached me with the offer, hey, Johnny, you're the Peace Corps expert in Peru. Why don't we join forces? And let's go for it. I said, hey, that's a wonderful idea. Great. So let's go. The first thing I did, I had written a couple of books already in Pisco, and I had done a lot of research. Visited most of all the bodegas. There's about 300, 400 here in Ica and Peru. Those for Pisco bodegas. And I had visited them all for my books and my TV program. And when Bill says, okay, let's go, let's join forces, I'll be the money man behind the project. You are the one who knows how to do the product. Let's do it. The first thing I did next day, Francis, was to come down and talk to my friend, Julio Pesquera. He's deceased now, but he's a good friend of mine. He and his son, Rodrigo, who owned this beautiful, 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 I mean, sensual, sexy, beautiful, beautiful distillery that dated from 1684, and I had seen the documents of the purchase of the property. And that made it the oldest working distillery in all of the Americas.
That's awesome.
Why? Because we needed a real story for our product. We didn't want a Mickey Mouse makeup story to tell, hey, we're not a new vodka, we're not a new rum, we're not a new gin. We've been here, Pisco has been here for 350 years, mm-hmm. and this distillery has been doing it, right?
Yep.
So buying that, we bought a couple of vineyards adjacent to the property. We own four vineyards now. And then we built in it, next to it, face to face. You have to come and see it. It's absolutely fascinating. In front, the most modern. Now, what did I do? I used the philosophy of the 1684 distillery to build a new one. Everything in 1684 was done by gravity. There was no electricity. There were no pumps. And that's why the Pisco in those days was so, so, so wonderful. Right?
Right.
And I said, I have to replicate that. So I told my architects when we were designing this, okay, my fermenters have to go 14 meters, 30-some feet up in the air to be able to have the height we needed to be able to bring all the flow, again, by gravity, right?
Wow.
So the whole brand-new distillery replicates the philosophy of the old one. I call it Portón Tecno Artisanal. We have, yeah, we're using the best of technology. We have computers. We have our tanks, our stainless steel tanks, are jacketed for cold weathers, for cold, to keep cold, to be able to keep the cold so we don't have a high temperature during fermentation and we don't lose aromatic structures. And everything is state of the art. But then the hand of the man, we still keep our Pisco in old, old concrete glass lined tanks. We still hand harvest all our grapes. We still hand select everything. Everything is a combination of technology and the element of artisan, the love, the man, the handcrafted beauty of Pisco.
So when did you build the new distillery? When was that completed?
The new distillery is 2 years now under operation. We started the project in August 2009, and we started, believe it or not, in January we were producing our first Pisco because the distillery, the old distillery, was working. The 1684 distillery was working, so we began to produce there. And a year after, we began in the new distillery, 2010.
And
so the product you have today is a 2010 in the market.
And you guys
as a matter of fact, Francis,
yeah.
As a matter of fact, yesterday, I mean,
you're out, Johnny. Right. You're out, Johnny. I lost you.
All right. Are you here?
You're back.
Yep, you're back.
Okay. Yesterday morning, I've been tasting with my people. We've been designing the blend for the 2011 bottling. Because, as you know, they have another argument here that I might drive you guys crazy and your listeners also. As Pisco, as Portón is made from wine, Mark, Francis, my argument is wine changes every year, and that's why we put a date on the bottle of wine. And Pisco is made from wine. Pisco has to change every year. Right?
I think that's amazing. I think that your commitment to that is amazing.
I mean, almost every other spirit I know.
They want consistency above all else.
Most important is consistency. And I had this conversation with somebody just the other day. I prefer quality to consistency. Somehow in the McDonaldization of America, we decided that it was better that it be the same all the time than it be great all the time.
No. Thank you, Francis. I am against that. I don't want to be a product that is exactly the same for the next 30 years. I would be bored to death. I would have nothing else to do. My job as a distiller, master distiller of Portón would be finished. I have beautiful grapes every year, and they change.
And
because I have more sun, more water, less water, more cold, less cold, but grape changes.
And will you date?
Changes.
Will you date the Pisco bottles
yes.
always?
As a matter of fact, when you see it, a little secret code, because for some reason we can't date it in the States, but we're working a little code in there so that we can more or less identify the dates.
I think that's tremendous.
So
now the other thing that's really interesting, I got to be honest with you, Johnny, you have a pretty forceful personality, and the way that you came into the American market sort of reflects your forceful personality. I'd never heard of Pisco Portón, and I think I knew just about every Pisco on the market. You know, you didn't exist until a couple of years ago. And you guys came to us early on, and you wanted to get into our place from New Jersey, and I think that's great, and we carry your product.
Yeah.
But when I brought in Pisco, I think I was one of the first guys around, or first guys I knew of to carry it. And now I really see it everywhere. You have, at least in the Northeast, you know, you guys have really, how did you take such a huge piece of the market so quickly?
I believe infiltrated is
Yeah,
the right
my term. God, you're everywhere.
Well, fortunately, we do have the resources behind the product, right? Which is very important. We have the resources and we have the commitment. Bill Gallup is a man in love with the project. So he has allowed a very substantial amount of monies for us to be able to pull this through. We've divided the states in four regions. We have a regional manager in these four areas. And now we have about 28 market managers and ambassadors throughout the states. We are now in 24 states, and we launched only in March last year.
Yeah,
right.
That's right. Well, that's, you know, the right. other thing the other thing about you, the way that you guys have marketed is, yeah, I see advertisements, but I see you, and I see you sponsoring a lot of professional and trade events. But I think that if the product weren't there, I think what you're doing
it's
gotta
is... got to be in the bottle.
Yeah, I mean, if the product weren't
sure.
there, you wouldn't have... You know, people order one bottle because of some deal, but they don't keep it on their back bar, you know. And it's I think it's a testament to the product. But it's amazing how quickly you've done it.
Well, thanks to you guys. I mean, thanks to you guys and a lot of people that have really enjoyed and enjoy the product and have tried it and liked it. But then again... We must be one of the spirits that has been awarded the most amount of medals last year. We've got 22 medals last year, gold medals, all over, in Spain, in Canada, in the States, in San Francisco, in New York, in Belgium, everywhere. We just picked up this year Chairman's Trophy in the New York Press Competition. We picked up a double gold in the San Francisco Ultimate Spirit Competition. And we just picked up last week, the Chairman's Trophy in the Canadian competition. So the product is good. And then we pick medals up here, down in the regional, in ICA, in NASCA, which for me are more important because I'm competing against my peers down here, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, one of these days you're going to hear an on-location broadcast from your distillery because it sounds like a hell of a lot of fun.
You have to come and see what we've done here. You would have so much fun. You would really enjoy it because it's really a beautiful Mark Francis. It is a dream. You have to see the vineyards, the neat rows, the way our commitment with nature. You know, we are the only distillery in Peru that reprocesses all the stillage. You know, the stillage is the wasted
right.
wine once we've evaporated the alcohol.
Right.
Normally, that here in Peru, all the distilleries throw it into the ditches. We brought almost $1 million investment, a plant from Holland that turns this back into water for irrigation.
Wow.
Oh, that's terrific.
So our commitment with nature is total. Our commitment with, our social commitment with the people that live around us. We employ everybody the closest we can to the distillery and to the vineyards. We employ about 120 people. We're not a small venture. Mm. We're a very, very serious operation down here, but we have a total commitment. You guys are going to think this is crazy, huh? Listen to this. They call me Gringo Loco down here. You know, the crazy gringo. Well, I've got a funny name, Johnny. It's not a very typical name for a local, right?
Right.
And I built some huge steel canals on top of my fermenting tanks. And everybody says, why did you put that structure up there? That must weigh tons and tons. Yeah? It weighs tons and costs a lot of money. But that is... a system that has drip irrigation, and I put vegetation up there.
Oh,
what?
You have a green roof?
You're crazy.
Yeah.
But underneath, right? So it's in the angle of each slant of the roof, there's this line of vegetation. Why? Because plants will take the CO2 from my distillate, from my fermentation process, and change it back into oxygen. Now, I don't know if it's going to work or not, but I thought it was a wonderful idea.
Hey, and it sounds like a lot of fun. Listen, Johnny, sooner or later you'll be seeing us down in Peru. Thanks for coming on the show, Johnny.
You have to come. No, my pleasure. Thank you guys for having me on board.
Johnny.
Salud, Portón, and enjoy it.
Salud, Johnny. Johnny Schuler is the founder and president of Pisco Portón in Peru. You can find out more about him at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. You know, we have a sort of a no cell phone rule on the show, but we had to break it because he was actually in the vineyard. Yeah, you know that we had a
Might not have been the easiest show to listen to, but he's, you know, Johnny's the most interesting man in the world.
He is, by the way. The hell is Dos Equis? You know, it's funny. I don't know if you could tell from his voice, but I bet there are a lot of women who just fell in love with him by listening to this podcast. He's a great guy. And he's
part race car driver. Yeah, he's got all the characteristics.
He came and did an event. He sponsored our Dale DeGroff event at the restaurant where Dale, you know, he sponsored Dale, actually, who came in and did On the Town, which was his song and dance thing. Well, no dancing.
So Dale did a song and dance. Is that
no,
what you're saying?
No. But he was great. I mean, I think that people were as charmed by him as they were by Dale. And the product is great. And, you know, it's a category that I didn't know about until 7 years ago. You know?
Yeah, it's obviously basically, I don't want to say new to the East Coast because we've had it for 150 years, but it's
300 years down there.
Right. But basically it was a forgotten spirit. Mm-hmm. That has reemerged.
Yeah.
It's changed from, you know, this kind of afterthought spirit to now it's got to be on your back bar.
And, you know, I had not sipped the Porton. I had not, it just didn't occur to me that Porton would be a sipping cocktail. And I sat with Johnny for about an hour and we sipped some.
Well, I remember when we first brought Pisco Porton in and we put it into our cocktails.
And we said, hey, that's not great.
And it was more, because it was more intense than the other Piscos, it was throwing our recipes off.
Right, we had to rejigger the recipes.
So we had to change everything that we wanted to use Pisco Porton in. We had to change the recipe because the Pisco Porton was actually a little bit too intense for most of our
wild stuff.
Most of our Pisco cocktails.
Wild stuff. But I'm going to Peru, okay? I'm going. Because you know what? You can go down and you can, where if you visit his vineyards, you can go down to you can go right across the Mendoza Valley. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to make that a trip.
Yeah, we'll do
a little
South American.
I would check out PiscoPorton.com. It's a cool thing. What they're doing down there is cool, and how they've resurrected an old tradition is what we really like, which is probably why we had him on the show. I hope you guys have enjoyed this hour as much as we certainly have. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com.